Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly radio show featuring the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, we welcome world-renowned cardiologist and digital health champion, Dr. Eric Topol, founder of the Scripps Translational Science Institute in La Jolla, California. He'll talk about advances that are paving the way for true personalized medicine in the 21st century. Lori Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's changing health and well-being in everyday lives. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Eric Topol on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and executive vice president and professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Institute at La Jolla, California. Prior to that, he served as chairman of cardiovascular medicine at Cleveland Clinic, where he founded the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. Dr. Topol is editor-in-chief of Medscape and has published over 1,100 articles and papers, as well as several books, including The Creative Destruction of Medicine and The Patient Will See You Now. He was named by Modern Healthcare as the most influential physician leader in the country. He earned his medical degree from the University of Rochester and completed his cardiology residency at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Topol, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks very much, Mark. Good to be with you.
Yeah, you know, we had you back in 2012, and it was a conversation we had about hope for opportunity to leverage genomics and digital health to advance the cause of precision medicine. Now, here we are in 2018, and you say that we're at a turning point of medicine, pointing to the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative recently launched by NIH. And I want to give out a shout out to Dr. Francis Collins. We were one of the 10 health systems selected in that initial cohort. And as a community health center, he wanted to make sure that this initiative really represented all of Americans. You see this initiative to gather complex medical data from 1 million Americans as an opportunity to reboot and reset everything we've thought about in medicine. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners why this initiative is such a transformational moment in healthcare.
Well, I think the biggest difference is that prior to recent times, we couldn't really understand the uniqueness of each person. We now have the tools to do that, and these are sensors and the genome and other biologic layers of information like the gut microbiome, even sensors to quantify one's environment. So up until recent times, we really practiced medicine in the dark, and now with All of Us that you mentioned and the tools that we have before us, it's a very exciting time to change medicine to be so far more individualized and precise with better outcomes that are expected, but of course prevention being, you know, being much more potentiated by these tools in the future.
Well, Dr. Topol, it's certainly a key goal of the All of Us initiative is to coalesce vast amounts of data from the million participants, everything from their genomic data to behavioral and biological data, I think race and ethnicity and people's habits, all to be collected and synthesized and shared among researchers, including, I think, the citizen researchers down the road. So I understand your organization, Scripps, was awarded a grant to develop something called a Participant Technology Center that would facilitate the collection and storage of data from these million participants. Tell us more about what you're creating at Scripps to support the All of Us initiative, and what's your guiding vision for gathering this massive amount of data from so many different sources?
It's called the Participant Center. That's a simple name for what we are doing, which is all the participant-facing technologies, like their apps, the website, data going back to them that they generate through their sensors or through their DNA or, you know, whatever the source of data that's generated to get back to each participant. And also, we're responsible for enrolling hundreds of thousands of participants through whether it's Walgreens clinics or whether it's blood bank centers, you know, labs like Quest. So we have a lot of responsibility at this participant center, but moreover, it's to keep the engagement throughout decades ahead for each of the million and likely much more than a million people that they want to be the citizen scientists and be active throughout their journey in the All of Us program. So that isn't just about getting data back, but also, you know, whether that's education, whether that's them making things fun, managed competitions, even incentives. You know, we're going to be getting a lot of the folks who wanted various sensors, like we already started a pilot with blood pressure watches. We're also doing a pilot of getting all the data for each person aggregated throughout their many years of their lives, beyond which they can just get from a single health system or provider. So we're doing a lot of things that are not necessarily for all million people, but trying to find out what is really promoting engagement along with useful data collection. So it's a pluripotent type of role or effort that we have, and we're really thrilled to be doing it.
Well, I love the word making it fun and engagement right. and thrilling, none of which could be ascribed to patient portals.
Right.
You know, and, you know, a lot of this is going to be done on smartphones, and they're going to play such an important role in the All of Us program. I was thinking back when you came on 2012, we were 5 years into the decade of the smartphone revolution. You've sort of talked about the smartphone as a Gutenberg moment in medicine, this sort of notion that we can have a new platform to democratize medicine. And hopefully we'll talk later about the ownership of that information as well. But there's been a lot of technologies that have been leveraged with the smartphone, like the FDA-approved EKG app you helped develop, or advances in gene editing. And you recently published the top 10 tech advances shaping medicine. I wonder if you could share with our listeners some of the technologies that we should be keeping an eye on.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's really kicking in now is the era of artificial intelligence in medicine. At the end of November last year, the first smartwatch electrocardiogram diagnosis of atrial fibrillation was approved by the FDA.
Right.
And that combines a live core with the Apple Watch. If you're wearing the watch, it senses for you what is your normal resting heart rate, what is your activity heart rate. And then if something is really out of kilter, it will give you a signal that you should take your cardiogram, which entails putting your thumb on the watch band. Mm. And then you get a cardiogram that's red, and then you're told whether or not you have an abnormal heart rhythm. So for people who, for example, they've had a fainting spell or they get dizzy and lightheaded or they have a known heart rhythm problem, this is a really nice tool that's now the first consumer FDA-approved artificial intelligence algorithm. There'll be many more, but the point being is that there's a promotion of more autonomy for each individual should they be interested in using these apps. We want to see them become widely available and inexpensive. But eventually, we're going to get well past. Right now, we have seen a big jump in diabetes technology, where no longer the new sensors, you don't have to calibrate them with finger sticks. Mm-hmm. They're factory calibrated. They're easy to put on, and they get very accurate continuous glucose measurements. But they're still, you know, relatively expensive. And the algorithms that support them are not very smart. They just tell you whether the glucose is going up or down. In the future, we're going to have algorithms that factoring in your physical activity, sleep, nutrition, your gut microbiome, you know, all these really relevant covariates that affect your glucose management. So we're right in the midst of new exciting technologies, but still a ways to go where, you know, we know where we need to be.
I couldn't resist just taking a moment to imagine what the arc of your career in cardiology must seem like when you think back to your earliest days of residency or fellowship training and watching the little spool of EKG paper come off of the machine to what
you have available today. Yeah, well, it was also the whole idea that when we had heart attack patients, we had nothing to offer them
exactly.
except oxygen and morphine.
Exactly.
And it's come
amazing.
A long way. And, I mean, it's been an area of great progress, but, you know, there's still heart disease along with cancer are you know, very major sources of death and morbidity, and we can't feel complacent. And much more work to be done.
And still working on prevention. But, you know, another person who we've come to know through interviews on the show who also has a long arc on the development of health and healthcare in this country is Dr. David Blumenthal, who we just had on the show again recently from the Commonwealth Fund. And he was talking about his efforts during the rollout of the HITECH Act, which, of course, led to faster, wider adoption of electronic health records over the past decade. but we haven't seen such great interoperability and, in particular, the ability maybe to tap into the flow of health information between patients and providers just remains a huge challenge. I'm curious what you see as the essential next steps to improving the flow of information. And I guess we now have to think of it in two ways, both the information that's going from patients to providers, but also the information that's going from patients' wearables and devices to providers who are not sitting at a desk somewhere waiting to receive it necessarily.
Yeah, well, first, you've mentioned a couple of some people that I really think so highly of, Francis Collins and now just David Blumenthal. As far as the data flow, the thing that I'm most passionate about is that everyone needs to own their data, their medical data. That's the only way we can achieve the coalescence of sensor, the traditional medical record, genomic data, you know, all these different sources, much of which don't go into the electronic record that sits in certain health systems, but it's hard to get at. So I am pushing for where each person has all their data on a secure platform, whether it be a private cloud or a blockchain or some type of hybrid of those. And then they can share it, whether they go see a doctor or they want to be part of a research program, but they are controlling it rather than sitting on massive servers, which are a magnet for cyber thievery and hackers. Medical data is the most valuable form of data in the world today, fivefold more valuable than your financial and personal data on the dark web.
Wow.
So we have got to fix this. No one has, in this country, has all their medical data. It should be prenatal all the way through their life, because even if they're in a health system they never move from, they can't get to all the data from earlier. Plus, they don't have their sensor data, you know, their genomic data all in one place, suitable for artificial intelligence or deep learning for that person, coaching that person in the years ahead. It won't necessarily be through a smartphone, but rather through smart speakers, voice assistants that will be medicalized. So instead of talking to your Alexa or Google cylinder, you'll be much using voice, and you'll be getting prompts, whether it's through text or voice, about, you know, your data. But you have to have all the data in to have good outputs, and right now we're not set up for that.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and executive vice president and professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Boy, you've touched on a lot of great things. We've got to liberate data, but people have to own the data. And then the whole voice activation opportunities that present themselves. And it sounds like you're thinking that the next decade will move into the voice activation interface for users. So that is going to be very exciting. But I worry about the hackers and the ability to grab information and sort of the lack of security. I think we had Samir Damani on recently talking about blockchain that might provide a reliable safeguard to protect our data. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what potential solutions are out there. I think HIPAA, Margaret, maybe 1996, it was first passed. I'm wondering who's laying out some of the technological standards as well as the legal standards as well.
Well, we're really not doing anything that's responding. I think your point about HIPAA being over 20 years old, and it's a relic now relative to what's changed in the digital world. Other countries are way ahead. The U.S. is in a kind of standstill mode. There's no question we want to protect privacy, but, you know, the whole landscape has changed. So something has to be done, but as far as I know, there's no move afoot to have a new legislation that's vital. Right now, our medical data is being sold, it's being brokered, it's being stolen and hacked all over the place. It's a sieve, and nothing's being done to protect it. So I'm quite worried about that, and I'd like to see both legislative as well as a technological solution. I've outlined the tech solution, but the one in terms of a new privacy, security, medical data bill is desperately needed, and hopefully we'll see it someday, but I'm not aware of any work that's being done actively yet.
And right on those topics that are just big, thorny, and hard to wrap your arms around is the cost of healthcare, American healthcare. But really, it looks like it's a problem everywhere around the world now in terms of rapid and escalating healthcare costs. It really resonated with me in a comment in some of your writing that we could help solve this problem if we gave inexpensive smartphones and internet access to underserved people all around the world. We're thinking maybe further disruption may come from the outside entities like Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan Chase's partnership. What do you see as the greatest potential for reining in costs?
Well, there's a few that have momentous impact. One, which is ridiculous that it doesn't happen, is that the government should be negotiating prices, mm-hmm. and they're not. Unlike anywhere else in the world, whether that's drugs and devices, we suffer. But as far as things that could be done, you know, the hospital setting is the hospitals account for 1/3 of the $3.5 trillion expenditures, which is, of course, rising each year. If you could get a lot of people out of the hospital mm-hmm. in their own home, getting sensors mm-hmm. and artificial intelligence monitoring, which can be exquisite and be as good as an intensive care unit monitoring, mm-hmm. but nothing's being done to get the hospitals gutted in this country, which the regular rooms could be basically be largely replaced by home monitoring. Mm-hmm. The reason, of course, is the fixation on current reimbursement paths that don't exist for home monitoring. So we have these, you know, perverse incentives to keep the system as it is, and that could reduce, you know, a tremendous amount. Another big on the list is all the inappropriate, unnecessary things that are done, whether they're scans, which we are an outlier in the world, or lab tests in a promiscuous or even inappropriate way. And they've been published, Choosing Wisely,
right care.
Right. All these things have been published, but nothing is being done to actually make it day-to-day medical practice. So, you know, we're talking about things that could reduce our healthcare bill from $3.5 trillion to potentially close to $2 trillion or less just by taking action, but there is no action.
Dr. Stephen Smith works with us on the Choosing mm-hmm. Wisely program, so we have been following that for a long time and couldn't endorse it more.
And trying to practice.
Yeah,
too.
Well, it's a great program, yeah. but it's made a list of all these things yep. that should be done, which none are being done.
No, absolutely. And I was thinking about, you've been focusing on how to redesign and redefine the clinical settings, and I could set aside the reimbursement system, but we know from our own clinicians, one more click and I would jump off the bridge here. You were talking earlier about maybe voice activation. How do we get the patient and the provider looking at each other? So we have to sort of think about that. And then just a sort of leveraging of artificial intelligence. You've been talking about in this whole context of telling people they own the data and they also have responsibilities on that. What's that vision look like of that new clinical setting?
Well, it'll be revamped. There will be no keyboards because natural language processing, just the natural voice of both the patient and doctor, can be made into a beautiful note and can be done. All the coding can be done from it. It's already been demonstrated. And not only that, but you'd have the patient edit the note because the patient's notes are often mistakes and they never get a chance to look at it. And then you have machine learning for the doctor so that they don't have to spend a lot of time reviewing it for that particular doctor or clinician. So we're headed to a keyboard-free zone someday. There's many startups and some of the leading tech titans like Microsoft are working on this. So it's just a matter of time. But the clinical setting is going to be affected much more than just that with respect to AI. It's going to give much more efficiency, productivity for every clinician. It's mm-hmm. going to give much more autonomy for patients. But all this takes time. It takes evidence. And hopefully, you know, of course, the cost reduction. But I'm very encouraged that over time, and this could be the way medicine moves, it could be a long time, but that over time we'll see a rebooting of the clinical landscape.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and executive vice president and professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. You can learn more about his work by going to stsiweb.org and follow him on Twitter at Eric Topol. Dr. Topol, thank you so much for your groundbreaking work, your enormous contributions to health and healthcare, and thanks for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump made two misleading claims during a campaign rally in Nashville. He said the individual mandate provision of the Affordable Care Act was, quote, so unconstitutional. In fact, the Supreme Court ruled the individual mandate was constitutional. In a 5-4 opinion on June 28, 2012, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the penalty, as it was described in the Affordable Care Act, is actually a tax collected by the IRS, and it is within congressional powers to impose new taxes. Trump can have the opinion that it should have been ruled unconstitutional, but it was not. The president made the claim in discussing the recent tax law, which eliminated the individual mandate tax in 2019. The president also said the Senate's failure in 2017 to pass a bill that would have repealed and replaced the Affordable Care Act, quote, cost our country $1 trillion in entitlement savings. Congressional budget experts say it would have saved a net total of $321 billion over 10 years, not $1 trillion. In addition to reducing health care spending, mostly on Medicaid, the Senate health care bill would have repealed or modified tax provisions in the ACA that provide increased revenues to the federal treasury. So while the legislation would have lowered spending by $1 trillion over 10 years, it also would have lowered revenues by $701 billion over 10 years. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Students of public health are often tasked with devising interventions for addressing some of health's biggest challenges. And for Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health students Dan Wexler and Priya Patel, their idea netted an award and launched a business idea at the same time. The students were tasked with addressing food insecurity in underserved parts of the world, including in neighborhoods in their own backyard. Families living in high poverty, low resource areas, and finding fresh, affordable, healthy food in neighborhoods with no grocery stores or food markets. They thought of the current trend of healthy mail order meals services like Blue Apron and wondered, what if we modified that business model to serve the needs of those living in food deserts? Wexler and his partner sourced food delivery companies that could provide prepackaged meal kits with all ingredients included, even spices, dressings, and recipes. And instead of home delivery approach, they designed refrigerated kiosks that could easily be placed in local neighborhoods.
I think the biggest change is that there is no delivery system door-to-door per se, and that by going and setting up these kiosks in the community, you can have a very lean design. You don't need a storefront. You don't need to pay for shipping. You don't need to have in-box refrigeration. And you are very much addressing the need of access by physically saying, hey, here is healthy food. It's convenient because everything you need is in the box. The directions are simple, very picture-based. There's a lot of literacy issues. And so just really thinking about how can we take all those lean design principles to facilitate access that really, I think, make it a solution that has the potential for impact.
And they also conducted research with local ethnic groups to create recipes that would resonate with their families.
And we just went down to the community and did taste testing at the farmers market and talked to people and said, you know, do you like this? What do you want to be able to eat for dinner? How do you want to cook? So basically, we have some dishes that are similar textures, similar spices. One thing that we found is there's a little bit of contention between parents who want to eat more traditional foods and kids who want to eat more American foods. And we tried to alleviate that and bridge those gaps. So one of our recipes, for instance, is a chicken pot pie pasta. So it's kind of American. It's fun sounding, but also We use a lot of traditional seasonings and spices.
Customers can simply walk to the kiosk and purchase their meal kits with the SNAP cards or cash. And they added benefits. The kiosk will be run by the residents of the neighborhood, giving them an opportunity to purchase the kiosk and run them like a franchise, offering an economic benefit to the community as well. Their idea earned them the Rabobank MIT Food and Agribusiness Innovation Prize and $15,000 in startup money to launch their enterprise, a low-cost, portable, healthy meal service placed in portable kiosk in food desert neighborhoods, offering families a simple solution to address the problem of poor nutrition, providing an economic opportunity at the same time. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.